Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzaku, Episode 70. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who talk about all things anime, manga, and other related topics we find interesting. The Kenzaku are...
Hey, I am Sam.
I am Dylan.
Hey all, I'm Mike.
And I am tonight's host, Nick. We are recording this episode on May the 8th, 2025, and the topic is Satoshi Kon's freshman movie effort, Perfect Blue. So with that, Hashin. So maybe per usual with our movie podcast, we'll start with the kind of the logistics around the movie. So it debuted technically in 1997 at a film festival, but it actually got a full theatrical release in Japan in 1998. As we mentioned earlier, directed by Satoshi Kon. I would say the only mainly notable other staffer was the screenplay being written by Sadayuki Murai. He's done a lot of screenwriting, especially from through the, let's say, 90s through the aughts. Just some notable stuff, at least, that caught my eye. He's done screenplay writing for Alien 9, which was kind of a quirky OVA in the late 90s, early aughts. He did Boogie Pop Phantom series composition and screenplay writing for some episodes, which definitely, I would say, has the strongest overlap in themes to Perfect Blue. He also did Bubblegum Crisis 2040. He did some scripts for some episodes of Cowboy Bebop. Also scripts for Dudarara. Yeah, so, you know, he's done quite a lot. Natsume Yujincho, he's done quite a lot of series composition and script writing for that. So I would say he's done some pretty notable stuff from the writing perspective.
This does sound like maybe the biggest one, though.
Perfect Blue? Yeah, I would say likely. I mean, Perfect Blue, I think, is a pretty defining title as far as anime kind of feature-length films go. I mean, when you talk about feature-length films from the 90s, especially, that are not Ghibli, this falls on a very short list of movies that immediately come to mind for me. Because I feel like feature-length anime movies really weren't, at a global level anyway, really a thing I feel until the 90s. I mean, obviously I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, so I have my biases, but that's just kind of how I feel based on the, you know, across the, especially the last, you know, now 20 years. I mean, we're seeing quite a lot of feature-length anime movies be going global and being very, very popular, especially from big creators like Hosoda and Shinkai.
Yeah.
But back in the 90s, I'd say it was pretty rare, especially standalone stuff that wasn't tied to a TV series.
Yeah.
Because I'm hard-pressed, like, gun to the head, I'm hard-pressed, especially from this, specifically the time period, let's call it late 90s, so 95 on, I'm hard-pressed to think of too many feature-length films that were not tied to a previous franchise. So, obviously, Eva, right? End of Eva is directly tied to the TV series that came out in 97.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think of other things that came out in the 90s, and late 90s specifically, and the only thing that came to mind for me was, and I don't even know if I'm right, was the Escaflowne movie in the 90s? Was that 99?
Yeah, yeah, that was also tied to the TV series, though.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying, though. Okay. Also, that was tied to TV as well.
Now, and Ghost in the Shell, which wasn't tied to a TV at the time.
Mm. Yeah.
No, manga, though.
Yeah. But that's probably...
I mean, Perfect Blue was an adaption of a light novel, though heavy on the adaption, because...
Very much so, yes. Actually, maybe you can talk about that. Yeah, so my understanding of how it came about was... by the time, because Kon only saw the script for the movie, he never actually read the book, is my understanding. So he only reason why he decided to take on the project because he liked the script a lot, and specifically because the original light novel didn't have the whole play-in-a-play kind of element of it. Oh yeah, maybe also spoiler warning, of course, we're definitely going to spoil the heck out of this, so if you haven't watched it, I believe it's available on Prime. Last I checked, I think it's on Prime. I could be wrong, but it's definitely available on some service. Maybe we should go over how we all watched it. I ended up buying the G-Kids Blu-ray for it and watched it off of that. What about the rest of y'all?
I watched it off my Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Same.
Okay, so we all watched it off of Blu-ray, which is...
Yeah.
I was pretty happy with the transfer, considering when this was made. It looked pretty great.
Yeah.
I would say for, you know, I was trying to, I believe I said in one of the previous episodes, maybe it was for either the Tokyo Godfathers or the Paprika episode, I said Perfect Blue was my favorite Kon movie with an asterisk of I have to rewatch it first to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still say that's probably the case, although I definitely was able to remove my rose-colored glasses and definitely have some critiques about the movie, for sure. But from a quality perspective, I had no complaints. Like, this is what 90s era peak, like, animation, really, to me. It's like a great example of it up there. This and, like, EOE, you know.
I will say, though, that, like, watching this, it looks amazing. But we've come a long way in animation. There's a lot of stuff that, at least I take for granted, like, the cells moving around between frames. Some, it's not like very stable.
The kind of the jitter.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, happens, oh wow, yeah. I haven't seen that in a while. So
yeah, no, yeah. That could be the anime boomer meme, but I actually kind of like that.
Oh no,
it reminds me that
it's cool, but it's like that never happens anymore. Like
oh yeah, because it's all digital.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, there's 0% chance of it happening, and of course there's merit to, but this. Definitely, it has that film grain look to it, right? Even though it's very cleaned up, like you can definitely see some of the imperfections in the actual its media itself, just because of the nature of how cell animation was in the 90s. I personally did not catch any obvious CGI in it.
Me either.
It all looked pretty much like excellent cinematography and great cut and angle selection. So not surprised, given that, you know, Kon is, that's like his at this point, well, I guess this is his beginning, but, you know, from what we've seen now, he's so great at assembling shots.
This, there was apparently CG in it, right? I seem to recall there being something in the credits.
Hmm.
Oh, was I totally missed that? Is that right?
Did I make that up? I don't know. I have a vague recollection of thinking like, oh, I didn't notice anything, but
so
it may have been like a Lane style. Yeah.
So you're perhaps making up something that happened, but you're also not sure if it happened as part of watching Perfect Blue, so that's pretty on
topical
theme.
Yeah, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. I don't know.
So before we start diving into the guts, maybe just a brief synopsis is in order. I can take a crack at it if everybody else is okay with that. Yeah. I actually think this one's pretty streamlined. So this, the plot is about a, let's call her a B-grade J-pop idol named Mima, who basically decides to leave her J-pop group called Cham, it's a trio, and basically dedicate herself fully to show business. Specifically, her kind of breakout, let's call it, role is this Japanese J-drama called Double Bind, which is about a mysterious serial killer who turned out to have, was it like multiple personality syndrome, for lack of a better description?
Yeah, sure.
And what during the filming of this, she basically is stalked by a crazed fan / otaku who basically builds a homepage about her and has a frightening amount of detail that only somebody very close to her would normally be able to see, like the kind of milk she buys at the grocery store. and then basically projects. And at first, she kind of finds it, you know, a little strange, but it aligned with how, you know, her day went, so she kind of found it amusing. But eventually, it started to diverge where the homepage was stating, you know, that she hated, you know, the show business. She hated how it was portraying her, and she wished things would go back to how it was and how she'd want to go back to, you know, being an idol. And that is when she kind of starts to have a psychological breakdown and question, is this what she really wants, or is this just what some, you know, imposter on the internet goes? And then she starts seeing hallucinations of this other Mima that is always dressed up in the pop idol costume and is basically, you know, telling her, oh, this is what you get for going into show business. And then towards the end, the big reveal happens, and that, and then the movie wraps up pretty quickly after the huge twist anyway. So we can go over the twist in a separate section, but that's, did I miss anything? I feel like that's the gist of it, right? I feel like it's relatively streamlined as far as plots go, especially for a Kon movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think that pretty much is everything. Like it sounds very simple, but it's all in the execution, right?
Yeah. And one thing I found real interesting was this. One thing that I realized was that idol culture really hasn't changed in the last 30 years. Because seeing how, you know, things were portrayed here, and obviously, like, some of the sensibilities, like the costumes and the song selection, you know, have changed, but otherwise, like, the things that happen to idols and kind of their general path in the industry, like, I saw so many parallels to this in, like, Oshinoko, for example, of, like, you know, obviously Oshinoko has some supernatural elements to it, but otherwise it's about, you know, an idol who ends up breaking in the show business.
I will say
and
that,
her,
while it is very similar, like, that the idol industry pretty much exists as it did then, I think it's pretty diminished these days, and like these kinds of YouTube stars have started taking that role. I mean, there's both of them are coexisting at the moment, but I wonder how long.
Definitely.
But aren't the YouTubers still largely signed with various agencies and stuff?
I think that depends.
Yeah, but well, for example, like I know for a fact the VTubers are all signed with organizations.
Yeah.
I don't know, and then I think there are certain ones that are for sure. But it's still basically, I guess that also ties in with the fact that, yeah, Japanese show business is so tied to the tied to organizations, right? Like, you can never be an independent contractor as far as, like, Japanese, like, show business is concerned. You always have to be represented by an agency, and the agency always takes their cut, right?
But this were kind of where the new, like, YouTube empowers creators to...
Absolutely.
Well, they may end up, you know, partnering to branch out, you know, taking an agency that they can get this started on their own first, which is, you know, great, because these companies don't have to spend money fostering talent. They can just swoop in and sign them.
Yeah, although I have no idea what the terms and contract terms are once you are signed with one of these agencies. I would assume the terms have to be way more beneficial than the traditional way of, you know, enrolling in the agency and the agency has to give you, you know, find you work and all that. Like, there is upfront work, obviously. But, yeah, so this predates... I mean, this movie came out at such an interesting time. This movie, I was talking with Dylan earlier off podcast, that it's such a fantastic snapshot of the 90s, right? It's like the beginnings of the internet kind of connecting, you know, fans of a particular thing or person together so that they can constantly have access to them in some way, you know, outside of just these live events. And Dylan took some great screenshots that just kind of, you know, really capture the essence of the 90s and how we're all pretty sure that they literally just kind of probably took photos of a Macintosh and just kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Because it looks just like I remember Macs looking back then. Even the splash screen on the OS where you have the side profile face and the, you know, up front profile face.
It's definitely like just a Mac. I wonder if they got permission for that.
Yeah, who knows?
Oh, did you go to the did Dylan? I see you took a picture of the website. Did you try and go to it?
Actually, I didn't try to go to it, but that was an interesting thing. Okay, so now I'm going to start diving into many millions of hypotheses on this movie, which I think is one of the things that makes it interesting. I watched it a few times, and I still am like, huh, I don't actually know what happened, which is really cool and rare for a movie that also makes sense. But one of the things, and I took a couple of these screenshots, and they have this angel-net.or.jp. And the first, and maybe someone has their own theory, but the first URL she goes to that she's told is like the home, and it's like Tilda Yubikazu, I think. And that is, that seems like that's where she goes. But then there's a different one later that she goes to that's Mima's room, which is the, I think it's Mimu is the after the slash URL. So I was trying to figure if at some point that it was changed, or like someone else took it over, or she took it over, or her one of her alternate identities took it over. Because if you look at the original like business card she was given that was told to go to Mima's room, it lists the first URL of the we'll call it Yoda, the Yoda URL, but then later she goes to one that's Mima. So I'm like, is this just an inconsistency, or is it an intentional inconsistency so that you have no idea what the hell's going on?
So my recollection is that the car takes her to a landing page. You have a photo of it. Yeah. So it takes her to this like portal of the idol online, and there's like multiple idols pages here, and then hers was just one of them from there. And so when you click the Mima's room, that then the URL would change to whatever the subdirectory is my understanding of it. I am not the web guy here, but that's I don't think it was particularly that deep, because we can talk about the main, let's call it antagonist, Mr. Mimania, as we knew him for it. So this was one of those interesting movies where you saw the main antagonist from start to finish almost throughout the entirety of the movie. At least you were led to believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure Mimania was definitely real, and he was definitely the web postmaster, if you will, and he was just a very proficient stalker, because he was definitely everywhere.
I didn't think it was him that made it. I thought it was like the person who made the site was
the manager,
and he Rumi. Was yeah Rumi, and she was emailing, he was emailing her because he thought he was talking to the real Mima, and then she would reply back and say, you know, oh hey, thank you, great fan.
Or did it change at some point when she...
So, yeah, that's a good point. So there's definitely a kind of a ramping psychosis as the movie progresses, right? That, like, you as the viewer start to wonder more and more what is actually happening and what is... just Mima's, let's call it hallucinations or her dreams or whatever they may be, because I feel like it started to get a little bit less clear, especially during the segment where she was supposedly gonna make a surprise appearance with Chem, right, on that rooftop concert. And
it starts going off the rails when Mima has the worst encounter with Truck Coon ever, because it leaves her in her own life, but crazier.
Yeah, where Mimania almost kills her, or does kill her, or that never actually happened at all.
No, she. In my opinion, she's definitely alive at the end. Like, the final scene, in my opinion, is definitely real, and that definitely is it. But I would say from the midpoint of the movie till then, there's a lot going on that is probably a mixture of fever dream and mostly real, and then probably some that was from the perspective of Rumi, who was pretending to be Mima, is kind of how I interpreted
so go,
it.
So going off one of the things, and if anyone else is interested at all on the Blu-ray extras, they have these lecture series that Satoshi Kon did on the movie, and they're really cool. It's not super long overall, but he talks about so much stuff, and going to the end of the film, Mima only ever sees Rumi through glass. She never actually looks at her not through glass, and then she only ever looks at herself really like in the mirror. So other people are there, but it also leaves this possibility that, like, I don't know. I'm left with the possibility that it's like, one, that she did, she actually was the one who did all of the killing, if those things actually happened. And
The murders definitely happened.
So who did them?
Right, that's the question, right? I don't think there's any question that the murders were fake, because the way the plot progresses is around the fact that, you know, these people are no longer there. But that's the real question, right? Is who actually did the murders? I am of the opinion that it was Rumi doing it all, as far as all of the question that what begs the question for me, and that is, how is Mima then getting these weird hallucinations and fever dreams of these things happening, like, from her side? So
I think it's a mixture. Like, what we see is not the real murders. We see her hallucinations. The murders really happen, but not necessarily in the way that she envisions it.
That's interesting.
That's definitely one way to think of it. I have another theory, and that is that I think Rumi is actually probably, like, microdosing some sort of, like, narcotics to her throughout a good chunk of the movie, because anytime something happens, like, Rumi is always, generally speaking, somewhere were accessible to Mima. So that's purely speculation. I don't think there's any real evidence. I've only watched the movie once for the purposes of this podcast. So I haven't, like, been super analytical as far as scrutinizing, but that's my theory. But yeah, Sam, I think you're definitely onto something, where it could just be that they happen for sure, and then when she catches the news of it happening, she then internalizes it herself, and because she's starting to wonder if, you know, there actually is another her, or, you know, if she maybe has multiple persons, because that's kind of they, in my opinion, Kon tried to pull, like, this like double gotcha, right? Because when they reveal the MacGuffin for the double bind drama that she's in, it turns out that her character actually was the perp the whole time, right? But was pretending, was thinking that she was the sister. Mm-hmm. So us as the audience think, oh, is that what's going on, and it's a whole Inception thing, right? Like, yeah, she thinks she was this idol, blah blah blah, and I'm like, oh wait, is that it? But, you know, and then towards the end, it's almost like a parabolic effect, where, like, from, like, the middle, like, early middle to, like, late middle part of the movie is where there's the most confusion, and then as we get towards the end, like, you start to see more lucidity again, mm-hmm. on what's actually happening, which I thought was a pretty cool really, really cool execution, really well written. And I know I've said this a bunch of other times in this podcast, but something that is best done using the medium of anime, I feel like, because you could probably now you can make this movie live action for sure, but there are definitely enough weird elements that made it ideal for anime.
I feel like what my interpretation of events was something like, she's having this crisis where she takes a gamble, right? She gives up kind of her dream of being an idol to be an actress. And at first it's going very poorly. And then she starts compromising her values to get this. And then meanwhile, it like feels like she misses the boat because, you know, her former idol partners are hitting it big. And then that kind of drives her crazy, like second guessing herself. And then combined with all the other things that happen, it just pushes her over the edge. And then on top of that, you have the whole drama that's planting seeds in her head of like another you, like the you could have been, making her doubt herself. So yeah, it's a really good movie. I have to say, when I didn't rank this one very high, and I didn't remember it at all when I watched it. And this was like fresh for me. Like, I didn't know anything that was going to happen all the way up to the twist at the end. I totally didn't remember any of that. It was like magic. This movie is higher than Paprika for me now.
I think I got to agree too. It's really good. And some of the stuff. So here might be the most weird and like surprising thing in the movie is that this movie, when it was originally released, got an R-15 rating. Like, oh, that's it. And Colin said in the interview, he was like, yeah, we probably could have gotten down to a G, except there was like a couple too many pumps in the rape scene. Yeah, he was like, well, you know, we were originally making the film as an OVA. It actually was originally started as an OVA, and then it turned into a film. So he's like, yeah, if we're doing OVA, it's kind of like, well, you push and you go these ways. And he's like watching that scene again. He's like, yeah, man, I really pushed that. We really pushed that really far. Like,
what's funny is that's the only thing that I really remembered about the movie was that scene. And I remembered it like, this sounds weird, but I remembered it being worse than it was. I had internalized that as an actually happening instead of being simulated, right? Like,
that was, well, they even go out of their way, right? Like, it's definitely an uncomfortable scene, yeah, like, no, yeah, doubt. But they cut it, and you know, they're all holding still, and like the actor who's assaulting her apologizes, like, oh, I'm sorry about this. She's like, no, you're good. Like, it's like, yeah, it breaks the tension, right?
Yeah.
And then like, oh, and action, and then she goes back to, you know, it goes back to being horrifying.
But at the same time, like, it does a really, really good job of kind of putting you, like, giving you a kind of a taste of how terrible this is, an experience it is for her, with the idea of, mm-hmm, like, these people that she ostensibly trusts are doing these terrible things to her. And it's like psychologically, you can understand how that would really just really mess you up.
And that is
100%.
That is, you know, often a thing in, like, sexual assault stuff, is people that you trust doing horrible,
yeah,
things. And then with this one, like, she totally dissociates in the middle of the thing, because aside from it happening once, then she has to go through and they're like, oh no, cut, do it again.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh gosh.
And you kind of get the feeling too, like, in the way that they're treating her, that they're also, despite the fact that it's, you know, it's just to show that they're also kind of taking advantage of the situation.
Yeah, and they're
doing things that they probably didn't need to do.
Yeah, like the writer.
Well,
fully,
I mean, they even the director and writer commented, was like, "Oh man, like ex idols are, you know, so beautiful, so they're perfect for scenes like this." Like, you can tell that, you know, they're starting to engineer kind of the plot around the fact that she is this young.
I just mean the guys in the scene were like being more aggressive with her than they really needed to do, doing some of the things that they were doing, or maybe more than they really needed to do to act out the scene.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's definitely.
But yeah, what you're saying is true too, right? Like, they're all taking advantage of her, right? And they're all kind of laughing about it, and very, very bad.
Yeah, but going back to the whole thing about, you know, this being a possible like mental breakdown of Mima and her dissociating, potentially developing a psychosis. The one thing I'll say is, because I don't remember big chunks of this movie, but I definitely remember the huge twist. Like, that was an unforgettable twist for me. So I was definitely paying attention to Rumi, and as soon as they started filming that scene, you see Rumi have this massive breakdown, right? Like, mm-hmm. she's like, and she just bursts out. That's like kind of the first indicator to me that, like, ah, this is where, because you don't see the murders happening until that scene happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is what made Rumi snap. And before, because when you think about the cadence of how the website was, it was still relatively, I would say, aligned with what Mami's or Mima's day-to-day was. And that kind of makes sense, because who else would have the visibility that there besides somebody who was very close to her? So my assumption is that early on, the Mimania and Rumi were in cahoots, and Rumi was feeding him a lot of the info for him to upload into the thing. But then once that scene happened, that's where I think they both were both aligned in that neither of them liked seeing Mima in, you know, have to take this route in showbiz. And so that's where it gets more deranged and more, it starts to diverge from what's actually happening in her day-to-day. And that's where, and then when Mima's seeing that on the webpage, she starts to also question it. I feel like that's the main, that's when the movie starts to really go kind of more like psychotic in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rumi is definitely got some issue going on, like, making that website to begin with or and all that stuff is kind of psychotic to begin with, but it's not like I'm going to murder you psychotic. But I think that's a really good observation of like that being the thing that kind of pushes her over to the edge to wanting to kill people over it.
It's interesting that Rumi, you know, I was paying attention to Rumi, remembering the twist and noticing that she's the one who objects to things and objects to Mima moving away from the singing career pretty early. And she always says, you know, voices those objections that Mima herself generally doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did get the feeling in the movie that Rumi was a kind of either a former idol herself or someone who always wanted to be an idol and couldn't. And that's why she was advocating so hard for Mima, so that she could kind of have the future that she couldn't. But you know, now we see there's this other level to it. But,
I think there.
You know, that's how I was.
I think there
it.
Was a,
there
a
was
line.
A line between Rumi and the manager guy. I can't remember his exact role, but who tells her that, you know, the age of her name as an idol has passed and things aren't like that anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's one of those films, I think, also that is so perfectly set when it is, where, like, you had this stuff where sometimes you had someone who was a younger person, like Rumi, who was like, what is this? Wait, what do I have to type? HTT? I can't do that. What are you talking about? Like, literally just, like, going online was a weird thing for people that were, like, hip and cool, and it was, like, just a normal.
I'm glad you brought that up. Because actually early on, it's almost impossible to catch this unless you are, I would say, have a pretty strong Japanese proficiency, and even then understand the nuances of the dialects. Because when she's on the early in the one of the early scenes when she's talking with her mom, she's speaking Hiroshima bin, Hiroshima is considered like a country town. So I was like, ah. Because they're talking about, you know, her. The only reason I know this is because I have a bunch of my families in Hiroshima area. And then she's talking about, oh, yeah, your uncle in Yamaguchi, in the Yamaguchi prefecture. I'm like, oh, that's where my mom's from. So I'm like, ah, that's why she's. So when she's talking to her mom, she goes back to the Hiroshima Ben very heavily. And that to me explains why she just doesn't understand PCs. Or she's, at heart, she's a country girl. So
I caught that accent, and I didn't, obviously, I couldn't place it, but I think they mentioned Hiroshima in another part of the movie. That's why I just assumed that it was Hiroshima. Like she was going somewhere or she went somewhere. I don't remember what they said.
One other detail I actually really liked was at the end. So this is post her, stopping the assault from Mimania and Rumi, air quotes, you know, finding her and rescuing her, and Rumi's driving her back, right? She's, and there's this, the line was perfectly executed. She's like, hey, you know, it's okay. Let's go back to Mima's room, is what she says. And that's when I was like, uh-oh, because, you know, that's kind of the final clue that, like, she's the perpetrator, I should say, of all this.
That never even clicked with me. Like, I was just waiting for the movie. It's like, well, I guess the movie ends like this, huh? Okay.
Right, because that's a weird way to say it, right? You know, let's just go back to your place. But she said, let's go back to Mima's room, is what mm-hmm. she actually says. And I'm like, ah, that's it. This is what's going to happen. And then the rest of this, after that, I was very, I remember very vividly, because the final conclusion of this movie was, is iconic for me, to say the least. Yeah. And, you know, it's brutal. Like, that's the other thing is, this movie has some of the most uncomfortable murders in all of animation.
Yeah.
I think they look terrifyingly believable. To a point where I was like, really, I was kind of like curling up in my seat. I was like, ooh, I forgot they were this, especially this, the scene from, I mean, the poster, right? Where she's got the ice pick and mm-hmm. is the pizza delivery for the guy that does the photo shoot of her, you know, in yeah. the nude. And I'm just like, oh gosh, that looks absolutely horrifying. And if you look at all the other murders too, the main, similarity was she always gouged out their eyes, and I always thought that was really unsettling.
This movie really does the horror angle of it really, really well.
Because it's believable, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
the horror angle was super believable because it was purely, you know, around psychosis. Because the cut I think I will now and forever love the absolute most is when, you know, Mima's escaping, you know, jumps off the balcony onto the other building, and you see, you know, Rumi slash alternate, or let's call it idle Mima, kind of, you know, angelically floating and like hopping around and, you know, it's like, how is this what you're and then that one cut towards the end where you see and she's just like running, just
she's huffing.
Slobbering like a rabid dog, yeah. right? I was like, oh my god. Like, when you see that, you're like, oh, it's yeah. so unsettling.
I like that as a little bit of almost comic relief there. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, because we are all thinking that at that same time, like, how is she doing this? It's like, well, she's not.
Yeah, she's so deranged that she's just, like, I mean, to the point where she's able to sprint full tilt inside with wearing those heels and, you know.
Yeah, at great effort.
With great effort, to say the least. But yeah, oh man, what a fantastic like final sequence.
Yeah, that part where the Nemanja, where she basically knocks him out, and then she comes back to bring Rumi, and he's not there. That was like, that was horrifying there too. It's like, oh, well, wait, where'd he go? I don't know. I got that feeling of like terror.
So what happened there, or what do you think happened? Well, yeah,
here's
what's
my
theory, which I think is just.
So
sticking on that, which is, I think that's one of the things that makes this movie fabulous, is that like we've all watched it and have all this stuff, but like every person for everything we've ever said about this movie is like, well, here's my theory, because it's mm-hmm. it's a cohesive film that nobody actually knows definitively like what has happened.
Well, you see a lot of actions and results, but you don't see the details, right? You see the beginning and end point, but you don't, the what actually happened in between is left incredibly vague.
Well, and they cast doubt on all of it.
Yeah, and then
too,
I'm
right?
like, did the end actually happen? Or did it happen the way we see it? Like, I think that's an interesting perspective of the idea that, well, we see some of these actions and murders and things, but maybe they happen, but maybe what we see is actually just Mima's version of what she has hallucinated has happened, but it's not actually what happened, and we never know what actually happened.
We know one I would assume that the very beginning of the movie and the very end of the movie is reality. This how we
all,
got
all
there
the all the murders are real. I'm convinced of that.
Yeah,
all of
sure
the people that died are dead.
Yeah, because they end up sure. on the news, right? So
exactly. So what yeah. I'm saying is, that's what I'm saying is, there's defined actions, like beginnings and endpoints of actions that we know, in my opinion, I think are fact. How they happened, I think, is definitely left for interpretation. So back to the final thing with Mimania. So my my theory and my interpretation is that the assault definitely happened. Mm-hmm. Mima actually stopped it as we saw it, where she grabbed the hammer and clunks him on the head. I don't believe that's when he died, because at that point there was no obvious blood, right? He just kind of passes out on the stage. My theory then is that Rumi is seeing all this happen after Mima escapes. Basically, Rumi comes in, drags him, Mimania, out, and that's when she finishes him off, because later you see his body and you see that he now has a puncture wound in his head. So my theory is that that's when Rumi finished him off. And then she goes back out and around to find Mima, and that's my theory.
And
anyway,
at some point in there, she kills the manager too, right?
Yes. So the manager was killed, I think, immediately before that, when he says, "Hey, I'm going to go to the wrap up party, so why don't you drive Mima?" I'm pretty sure that's when she just murdered him right there. Because when you think about it, she had to because their bodies were in the same place.
Yeah, I was.
So it had to be somewhere on the set.
When I was watching the movie, I had assumed it was like a kind of a double murder. But now, as we're talking about it, like as soon as I mentioned that scene of his body disappearing, I was like recontextualizing things. Being like, wait a minute, he didn't do that. That was Rumi must have been involved somewhere. Yeah, so that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's why, at least the way I interpret it, is all the murders were Rumi doing it, and basically dressed up and impersonating Mima.
I think Mimania was some of those. I think at least in the beginning.
I don't know. The first person that got killed in a car accident. I really don't think Mimania was driving.
What's the car accident?
No, are you talking about the rider?
Yeah, the writer.
The writer was assaulted in the elevator, and his eyes were gouged out.
Yeah, you're right. I remember that. I'm trying to remember.
I don't think Mimania. Oh no, Mimania did kill somebody. He killed the belligerent fans that were harassing Mima at her concert. Remember, he did run him over with a truck.
He did, but again, that assumes he actually could drive.
True, but I think that's the only murder, because that's the only murder we don't see in film, and I feel like that's probably the only one that Mimania actually did. I think all of the rest were all Rumi doing it, because when you look at how they were done, they were all the same way. You know, multiple vicious puncture wounds with eyes getting gouged out, what we now know is an ice pick. So that's my theory anyway.
I could buy that. I think I'm not totally convinced, but that sounds pretty plausible. I like the theory of like the ice pick being the connection between the difference between the two people.
So why the eyes?
Maybe because they all saw Mima in a way that Rumi didn't want them to see, so she wanted to take that away from them.
It's fair. Yeah.
When you think about the writer is the one that wrote the rape scene, the photographer was the one that did that whole photo shoot. The manager was complicit in all of it.
That would argue that maybe the reason that Rumi killed Mimania wasn't because of what he had done, but because of what he saw in the process.
Basically cleaning. I mean, there's also that cleaning up loose ends, but
she wasn't very clean.
Yeah.
Well. No, but
this is where I want to start. I still now stand firm. This is probably my favorite Kon film. But when you think about it from a rational perspective, the second that the mail bomb happened, I can't imagine that the filming of the drama would have continued completely without issue, and then even more so after the writer is horrifically murdered.
Yeah, that was weird to me.
There's no way they would have kept filming that in real life, and that was the only thing I was a little bit incredulous. I was like,
I have a separate question on Double Bind, which is, what network is airing this psychological drama that also has like topless and full nudity rape scenes?
Oh no, that's in 90s Japanese, really? Dramas, that's totally normal.
Jeez.
Oh yeah, no, I remember, because in 1995 when I was I'm sorry in 97 I was there when I was there in 97 to watch Mononoke, I was visiting my relatives, my aunt, in Fukuoka, and she and she and the family would, their family would always watch various J-dramas, and the assault scene, I think, was a bit much, but there was plenty of nudity in Japanese dramas in the 90s. Like,
so it was just Cohn, just as he even acknowledged, he's like, yeah, I went a little bit far on that assault scene, but it's like, well, if it had been slightly less, it probably would have been actually fairly close to what was on. Huh.
I mean, Satellite was pretty big at that time, too, so it could have been basically a cable show.
Yeah, it's very
Japanese for, HBO type thing.
I wouldn't say Japanese HBO, but actually there was an interesting analysis I also saw about this, where Kon was kind of also poking fun at the Japanese like drama industry, because at that point, you know, when you look at what was big in Hollywood, you had movies like Seven and Basic Instinct and Silence of the Lambs, and you could tell that, you know, Double Bind was just more or less following that trend and, like, you know, just trying to be, do that, but in, you know, with Japanese budget and Japanese actors. And he, I think that was him. And I agree. Well, the analysis was that this was him kind of like making fun of that, you know, how Japanese, and let's be real, Japanese TV famously is pretty lackluster.
Yes.
So. Yeah, you had the Buffalo Bill woman suit mentioned essentially as a plot element in Double Bind, and then the Basic Instinct ice picks, I guess. So.
True. So yeah, that's the only, I would say, element of the movie where I was just like, I don't know if I would think, I was a little bit incredulous. I was like, after these murders happened, there's just no way that they would be moving on with the production. And then on top of that, especially after the photographer is murdered, there, any competent detective would be able to draw a correlation, like, is there a common threat? And then she would have been at least questioned, right?
Yeah.
So that's where, like, the complete and utter lack of actually police presence at all in this was the one thing I was like, really?
Oh, that I guess reminds me, she had the bloody clothes in her closet, like, what?
Yeah, but Rumi had access to her room, though.
Yeah, yeah, so no, I mean, Rumi, I get that, but, like, nothing, like, why would Rumi do that? Like, that part I don't understand.
Well, but that was also part of the hallucination, unless, though, I feel like.
I guess it maybe.
Unless the other theory is that maybe not all of them, but maybe a lot of them, Mima actually did the murders herself.
Right, because she was also kind of going crazy. So she could have.
Well, the pizza delivery person doing the murders looked probably female, though it was hard to tell from the angles they gave.
Well, and of course, the movie makes you question everything you see, right? So,
yep, also true.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, again, this is, like I said earlier, the details are intentionally left, you know, vague and made to question, and I think it's the whole point of it is to have discussions like this about it, like, who, what really happened, you know, what, who did what. So I think based on what Dylan was saying about the little lecture that Kon was giving, he didn't go out of his way to fully explain. He definitely seemed to leave it open to interpretation,
which is so good.
And, like, there's so much other good, you know, it's one of those, it's a brilliant movie, which is such a great Kon movie as well, because there's just so much thought and detail and everything, and stuff like where Mima has the discussion, has the phone call with her mom and talks about that stuff, but you never get, like, the exposition of Mima is an idol from Hiroshima. So it's like, no, it's just a little... Yeah. Background tidbit there that can add a little bit of something, but it's just as part of the conversation and the script, and it's not a let's take a break and give the exposition. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's kind of something that Paprika does more of than I'd like. Although it is weird and kind of surreal, I think it still spells stuff out a bit too much. And that's why this one is so much better for me, is it just leaves that stuff there for you, and you can decide what to make of it. Doesn't explain anything to you.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't need to be, and it doesn't have to be, because again, we get the clarity at the end to give us that feeling of, you know, conclusiveness. But again, we see the beginning and the end, and the path in between can be drawn any number of ways and interpreted any number of ways, and maybe none of them are right or wrong. It doesn't really matter, because ultimately I think it accomplishes that, and I think that's what Coyne wanted, and I think he accomplished it beautifully with this movie. It's so hard to leave things you know, uncertain without and still being conclusive at the end. I feel like it's really challenging to do that, and I think he did it incredibly well with Perfect Blue.
Plus there's the other stuff, like, of the whole, just kind of, it's also a very interesting slice into the internet, where I grabbed one of my screenshots was when Mima's on the train and there's the ad on the side on the, you know, little ad billboard in the train that says, you know, like, you can make a homepage, you can make an internet. And like, it is so, it's like, it's so authentic. Like, and it's one of those things where, like, if you were a younger person watching this film, you'd be like, oh, that's such a, like, a weird, that's so, like, quaint or weird or whatever. But it was like, that stuff was like all over the place. It was such an, that the ad and this stuff there is like, yes, it's Japanese language, but in America, we had exactly the same, like, ads in exactly the same way of, like, go on the internet, you can make a homepage too. Like,
this was still when, like, AOL and, like, CompuServe and things, those were still dominant services, like, that weren't even really the internet, right? And I think about this time they were connected to the internet, but, like, yeah, it was
a wild time.
Not everybody had a computer.
Now nobody does, and everyone's just on Facebook or TikTok or whatever, which isn't really the internet either. So it's all come full circle.
Yeah. Interesting, the internet element. Like, do you think this movie works as well if they made it even a couple years earlier? Or do you think the internet element is part of what transforms it from a pretty mid-novel to a really good movie?
I think it's an important part of the plot of the movie.
I agree.
Like, and it's, you could do it maybe in a different way, but it would not be the same movie. Because I think the internet brought internet brought stalking to a whole new level.
Yeah,
it brought the immediacy to it. Like,
yeah,
it's hard to imagine Mimania and Rumi sending, you know, mimeographing zines to each other.
Right. Yeah.
I think the way it was, the way it's presented and the believability of it was, it was only in this very narrow time, because, you know, the whole acceleration of everything on the net, right, with, especially with video stuff, like, I feel like in the modern era, nobody would be able to, everybody, first thing is, oh, prove it, right, prove it, you're the real one, whereas in the back in this era, it's like, there wasn't really easy ways to do it, and nobody really questioned it, so.
It wasn't normal necessarily to even have a webcam or digital camera.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, yeah, again, there's this very narrow window of time where this movie could, where it makes sense for everything that happened in this movie to still feel, like, believable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a wonderful snapshot of the mid-late 90s and kind of the beginnings of, you know, all the wild things that the internet has become now.
No, I was just saying, that's a great point, too, that it also does accelerate and shows the future of stalking in 1997 as, you know, if it were done these days in the U.S., it would be something similar, but with, you'd have to add in the doxing and swatting and all of those other horrible things. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And deep faking.
Yeah. In these days, people broadcast where they are at all times, so, you know, it's just a lot less difficult.
I mean, yeah, I mean, not to bring it too recent, but what, like a month ago, a Japanese vlogger was, like, literally stabbed to death, like, while she was live streaming.
I just heard about that.
That was, yeah, that was dark. I mean, after looking at the details, she definitely wasn't completely absolved of innocence. Yeah. It turns out she basically scammed that guy out of, like, tens of thousands of dollars of money that he put himself in the deep debt to get for her, and she never really paid back. So, you know, she definitely was scamming him. Doesn't mean she should have been murdered.
Yeah.
But, you know, not as, not once, she was not a fully innocent party in it. Still, again, obviously, you know,
yeah,
not.
It's outside the bounds of just a crazy stalker. It's a...
Yeah, but still, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes a lot. I think the whole sentiment of maybe, I mean, this could be a topic for a future one, because a future podcast is kind of Japanese sentiment of like all this. Because Japan, it's funny, because Japan, for being as, you know, initially very adoptive of all technical stuff, these days they're so anti like vlogging, and like there's even kind of a negative push towards like the excessive tourism now. To the point where, you know, they're going to be implementing like a tourism visa, I believe, soon. They didn't say when, but they actually announced that they're going to be implementing one because of over-tourism. Wow. and stuff. So, you know, hopefully it won't affect any future Kenzoku trips there.
Yeah.
But, wow. So this hour flew by.
Yeah, yeah.
I was kind of wondering if we were going to have enough material to talk about. I wasn't super, uncertain, but yeah. You know, so
yeah, same.
This is now the third of four Satoshi Kon, you know, feature length films that we've done a full episode on. So, having watched this now, my final question to the remaining Kenzoku is: has your personal ranking of Satoshi Kon's movies changed at all after watching this, or is this still more or less what you're... Now, I'm not going to expect any of you to remember what your exact rankings were. I don't... That's a little asinine. But, you know, maybe just after watching this, if your input on where you think it belongs in the hierarchy has changed. Let's start with Sam.
Oh, I mean, definitely. I said it earlier, but it's higher than Paprika for me. I think Paprika might be at the bottom now for me. I think it might be Paprika, Tokyo Godfathers, then Perfect Blue, and then Millennium Actress. But, you know, we'll need to watch Millennium Actress, and then I can re-rank them again, maybe. This movie is way better than I remembered it.
Interesting. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, the ranking Sam described, Millennium Actress, Perfect Blue, Tokyo Godfathers, and Paprika, is basically where I came into this with, and after this rewatch, that's where I'm still at. Though we'll see, because I haven't watched Millennium Actress in a while myself.
Okay, and what about you, Dylan?
I think I'm gonna... I don't know about the rest, but I think I might put... I don't know. We gotta watch Millennium Actress again, but it might be up top. It's so good. It's so interesting, and it's one of those ones where, I guess here's the hardest thing is like, okay, would I recommend this movie for everyone to watch or not? Because there is so much just like hard graphic stuff that you're like, people could be like, whoa, I was not ready for this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's tough.
Like, it's easy and it's tough.
For that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to recommend if you know enough about the other person's
taste. Or give them a warning and be like, just so you know, like, like, you almost want to have a trigger warning of like, hey, just so you know, like, there is graphic content, like, intense.
If there ever was a case for a trigger warning.
Yeah, I feel like this is a fair movie to say that, and somebody might just be like, you know what, I'm not doing this movie, or I'm just not doing it right now. And you could be like, all right, that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could probably just ask, hey, did you enjoy movies like Seven, Silence of the Lambs, or Basic Instinct? If the answer is yes, then you probably can make the recommendation. If they're like, if their answer is, what are those? Then you might be like, well, as for me, I believe my ranking was Perfect Blue at 1, Millennium Matrix at 2, Tokyo Godfathers and Paprika. I could... Maybe a couple of those have switched, but I would still probably keep it that way. But barring watching Millennium Actress again, I just feel like, for me, the hook in this movie is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And Millennium Actress was more of a of a, like, you know, like a narrative, like start to finish narrative movie. I don't remember tons of it, but I don't remember there being like a big, like, whoa, surprise at the end of it like this. So just for that, I might put it down slightly. But yeah, I would say in general, this is probably the least recommendable of the movies, but it's also my favorite. Because of what it's of everything we just described in the last hour.
See, I think it's the most recommendable with the trigger warning. I think if you give that, or you just know that the person is going to be fine with it, then you'd be like, all right, definitely you have to watch this movie. It's so cool. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it's framing. Yeah. Given the trigger warning acceptance, yeah, I can say that this is the one that I could recommend the easiest, as far as, like, there's very little out there like it, and it's gonna blow your socks off in its execution. You know, if it's like a pick a random person in, you know, stranger in the street, I would always recommend Tokyo Godfathers, because that's the easiest one to recommend to a random person.
Yeah,
like, this movie is probably easier to recommend to a generic cinephile than it is to a generic anime fan.
Depending on the era of anime fan.
Yeah, I might agree with that.
Yeah, I think so. If you liked definitely. Ninja Scroll, you will like...
I think this puts Ninja Scroll to shame.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, just in terms of graphic content.
Leans on, graphic content, sure. Sure, totally agree. But yeah, so I'm glad we all enjoyed it. I was concerned that my rose-colored glasses for this movie were unfounded, and that it was going to be not as enjoyable as it was. But it turns out it's still excellent, holds up great. You know, again, we just further proof that we lost Satoshi Kon far too soon. I would have loved to see him do more, but still doesn't, you know, still have one more that we can get to complete the quadrilogy. when we'll get to that is up in the air. I believe tentatively for the next episode, which recording date is still TBD, we're going to do another full-length movie, but this time in the live-action genre, the 1977 Japanese horror film House, which I believe Dylan confirmed is correct. Available on Max. And also, I believe, is purchasable on DVD.
There's
through any
Criterion.
Number of retailers.
And it's available on Criterion channel as well, if anyone
Criterion.
Has that.
Criterion, at least. It's a movie
also the Criterion channel.
Well enough regarded to be in their pantheon of stuff. Hey, they had to pay. You know, Armageddon paid for
it's
a
classic.
Lot of movies. I think I remember seeing hearing one of their producers or someone at some time being like, we're like, oh, Armageddon, you're like, they're like, that paid for like 150 other films. So like, we're fine with that.
There we go. Well, yeah, so that's what you guys have to look forward to next time. But until then, this is AMO Kenzoku signing off. Saraba.